Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder, you know, a founder that basically is going to tell us a thing or two about building, scaling, and financing a business. You know, they've accomplished incredible growth with the business. They've also raised quite a bit of money. They have offices in four different places around the world with over 270 employees. And we're going to be talking about coming from Europe to the US, you know, what that means, and also how to think about scaling. What are some of the issues when you're scaling? How you think about letting go of your ego? What does it look like when the company's outgrowing teams? All of the good stuff that we like to hear. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Benz Jędruszka. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Alejandro, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and would love to share any and all ideas I might have.
Amazing. So born in Hungary. I know that growing up, you moved quite a bit because of your dad's job. So how was life growing up for you?
It was not easy because my father's job, he was actually working for GM. And we moved a lot around the world, moving from Romania to Russia to Kazakhstan, and then ultimately back to Hungary. And, you know, it took a toll on me in the beginning. But generally, what I had learned is if you can handle naturally stepping out of your comfort zone, that actually becomes a superpower for you after a while. And I'm still sort of like reaping that in my adult life as well. It's very easy for me to step out of my comfort zone. Hence the reason why I decided to move over to the US from Hungary last year, in the beginning of last year, and to support our US expansion, basically.
How was it for you? I'm sure that it shaped you quite a bit, you know, moving around when you were growing up, going from one place to another place, making new friends. How do you think that allowed you to deal with uncertainty?
It's allowed me to get comfortable with it and allowed me to, you know, when you move from Hungary to Romania and you don't speak, you're like 7 years old, you get into a school where they speak English. There's all these new faces around you. You have no friends. You don't even speak the language. You pretty much learn to sort of like adapt to the new environment, make new friends, and, you know, start surviving. And then that happens 3 years later, it happens again. And then 2 years later, it happens again. So after a while, you treat it as natural. And I guess I am, like I said, even in my adult life, like I'm not afraid of change. I know everything's going to be fine. I can adapt pretty quickly to whatever changing environment I am experiencing.
So then let's talk about how you developed the love for engineering, maps, physics. You know, where did all that come from?
Yeah, I've always been a numbers person. So it's just very logical to me. Or at least it seems very logical to me. And I always like to understand why things are happening in the way that they are happening. And I just felt that maths and physics and science generally are able to describe what I am experiencing in the world. And there's very logical reasoning behind those. So that's what got me on the path of either, you know, becoming an engineer, or studying economics and understanding like the greater sort of on a grand scheme of how the world works. And I ultimately chose the path of economics, and I started studying business and management in university.
So then let's talk about university, because university in Hungary was quite a pivotal for you. You know, that's where you met your co-founder and where you guys started to daydream about a future where you could do something together. So that eventually got you into cryptocurrency. So walk us through what was that experience like? Why you guys actually connected so well? And then what did that daydreaming look like?
Sure. So Tomasz, my co-founder, we were good university friends, and this was early 2010s. And this was in the, not even the Wild West. This was in the time of cryptocurrencies when it was not popular at all. Like, I mean, you could basically if you researched what it was used for, it was mostly used to exchange goods and services that were related to illicit activities generally. So there was a bunch of darknet markets that had relied on cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, and they were being shut down and restarted. And that was just really interesting to us generally. And we thought, why don't we start a crypto exchange? We truly believed in crypto. So we thought, like, in the future, cryptos are going to be much more popular than they were back then. And we saw a lot of, we just saw an angle there, which was very interesting to us. So we wanted to start as a hobby project, as we were, you know, having beers after school. We wanted to start a crypto exchange. And that's exactly what we did. And so after starting to accept credit card payments, we recognized that we were being hit with a bunch of fraud, and people are checking out with stolen identities, stolen credit card information, and it's a major pain. And so that was no news to us, because even as we were reading these darknet forums where they talked about cryptos, it was clear that even the most basic script kiddies could learn to fraud businesses online, because the Tor usage of the Tor network, general sort of the wave of cryptos becoming more and more popular, was a perfect inflection point. Like, anonymity from all aspects was a perfect inflection point for fraudsters to start doing what they were doing on a larger scheme. And so, long story short, on our crypto exchange, we had to solve the issue of fraud. And we said, okay, let's put our thinking hats on and let's start thinking like these fraudsters, and how could we actually filter them out? And we looked at the marketplace back then of fraud tools. There was nothing that we specifically liked. Everybody was aiming for an enterprise sales motion, and we weren't their ideal customer profile. So we started building our own internal fraud tool, and we started monitoring IP address, whether there's any VPN or Tor usage as they're checking out. We started monitoring the email address. We started looking for discrepancies between billing information and the IP location and such minor sort of trends. And we quickly dived very deep into the intricacies of how fraudsters are thinking, and the rest is history, I'd say.
So then what happened next?
Yeah, we built our own fraud tool. And we realized that this is a problem that's not going to be going anywhere. It's a very sticky issue. Almost every online business is impacted by online fraud. And we said, okay, we're going to pivot. We're going to forget about our crypto exchange, and we're going to be building a fraud prevention tool from now on. And one day, we are going to take this business public. And that's still our aspiration today. And that's what we're driving for every day. And we're, you know, at the same time, we're helping all of these amazing online businesses to solve their fraud-related problems, except on a much more professional level, you know, 8-9 years later than what we had originally thought we would be doing.
So what ended up being, Benz, the business model of the company? How do you guys make money for the people that listen, you know, to get it?
It's very simple. So there's various levels of checks that we can support the businesses that we're supporting with. So we can monitor fraud at the point of registration, at the logins, at the point of a transaction or a checkout process. These are a couple of examples. There's many different angles where during the touch point with the consumer, our customer integrates us and we have a simple API integration. And then we basically bill based on the usage of our system. So the more checks we do, the more you pay, and you basically pay a couple of cents per check.
So you guys got started in Europe, and I know that eventually you came here to the US, and that's not easy. What was that journey like of, you know, figuring out there in Europe, hey, I think that we need to pack the bags and also expand over there. You know what? How did you come to that realization, and how difficult was that transition?
So we originally started building our business out of Budapest, Hungary, where it was the two of us, my co-founder, and then slowly and steadily we had a team of 5, then 10, then 30 people. And then all of a sudden we realized we're serving customers in the European region, in Asia Pacific and in Latin America, and we have a decent revenue share from all these areas. And we knew that stepping into the US was not going to be easy because it's a very competitive market. Most of the competition was based out of there. And at the same time, every time that we had talked to a US prospect, their first question was, okay, do you have a US entity? Do you have any customers from the US? And do you have a US sales account? You know, do you have an account executive based out of the US that I can talk to? And the answer was always no to each of these questions. So we consciously did not step into the US market for the first approximately three years of our operation, because we felt we could drive enough revenue from all these different markets that I had listed before. And we were growing in these different markets. And we knew that we would need more dry powder to basically tackle the US market. And so I think it was after our Series A funding round, which was in around 2020, something like that. I mean, the years are flowing, like they're kind of flowing together. But after our Series A funding round, everybody told us, every founder that we talked to who made the leap from Europe to the US, they told us it's not gonna work out if you just deploy troops over there. Like, either a founder has to relocate or you really have to hire some very senior leadership out of the US who you hold their hand very closely and you travel a lot and they understand the product that they have to sell. They understand the market deeply, and they also live and breathe your culture as a company. Otherwise, they're just going to be a detached limb, and they're not going to succeed. And so we don't really believe that as first-time founders. And we just hired a couple of account executives and people in charge of cold outreach, and we brought them to Hungary for like 2 months. We thought we would train them and then send them back to the US, and it's all going to work out fine. And we sent them back. And we had tried for about a year, and we realized like this is not going anywhere. Like we're not able to gain traction. And that's when we made the conscious decision that somebody's gonna have to relocate. And that's how I decided in the beginning of last year that I would move to the US. And I moved last January to Austin, Texas, where we have our US headquarters. And in the meantime, we had also hired our chief revenue officer out of the US, who transitioned into the company beginning of last year. And he's been doing an amazing job of up-leveling the whole revenue organization and transforming the whole revenue organization.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So talking about the revenue, I mean, you guys were tripling year over year. And that growth also, you know, came with some dangerousness attached to it. So what happened there? You know, I mean, when you're thinking about tripling year over year, you're like, my God, you know, we're making it happen. But, you know, that came with some pains. So, and with a course correction. Yeah. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, there was a time when we went from $1 million ARR to $3 million to $10 million ARR. We tripled our revenue year over year for a couple of consecutive years. And it was a crazy time of growth. That is when I think we went from like 30 people to 250 to almost 300 people all of a sudden in a matter of 24 months. And, you know, you start out with, you're sitting in a room and you can gather everybody and you can interact with everybody on a daily basis with around 30 people. And then all of a sudden you're 250 to 300 people sitting around in different offices around the world. You've got time zone differences that you have to account for. It was a crazy time of growth, and we made a lot of mistakes. We thought that whatever worked at the smaller scale, we can just replicate that at a larger scale. And in reality, that assumption was completely wrong, because we had to processize things. We had to implement systems and tools and processes and actually find the right leaders to scale those given functions. And in a lot of cases, we don't even take the time to do that. You know, just being very, like, as I speak about it, I'm being humbled by thinking of that time. There were cases where we would scale a team from, I don't know, 5 people to 20 people in a matter of a couple of months without hiring the right leader first, but just, you know, promoting people internally. And thinking back in hindsight, yeah, I learned a lot, and so has my co-founder from that time. And yeah, in certain cases, it didn't end well. We had to realize that we made some mistakes, and we had to course correct those mistakes and make sure that we implement the right systems, processes, and find the right leaders for the teams and also the right people for the teams, because in some cases we were missing them.
And in terms of, I mean, right now, I mean, incredible, you know, the growth, you know, you guys are like at about 40 million ARR, 4 offices around the world, 270 employees. I mean, obviously that level of growth too requires support and infrastructure from a capital perspective. So how much capital have you guys raised to date, and how has it been also going through the motions of raising money?
Yeah, we have raised around in the ballpark of $100 million thus far. We closed the Series A funding round around in 2020, and then somewhere in the first quarter of 2022, we closed the Series B. So there wasn't a long time delay between the two. And I might even, like I said, the years are, the exact date, if you ask me right now, I'm not going to recall it. But generally speaking, raising capital has not been difficult for us. I think, like I said, fraud is a growing economy, and businesses are actually spending more and more on fraud tools year on year. And so the economy's there, right? Like it's a sticky problem, and investors are generally, from my perspective, they want to be investing in cybersecurity and fraud prevention. And at the same time, you know, if you see a company that's growing very healthily, then fundraising is not an issue from our perspective. And we've always closed our rounds pretty swiftly, and we've chosen the right investors. And it's been, yeah, it's been pretty good past couple of years.
So then let's talk too about growth, because, you know, with growth, like we said also, you know, it could be that it may outpace teams, outpace people. It can also make you reflect on, you know, why it makes sense to perhaps let go of egos. Well, what can you tell us about that too?
I mean, coming back to the topic of growing and making mistakes, I think another difficult aspect of growing your business is understanding that whatever worked from 1 to 10 million ARR is not going to get you from, necessarily not going to get you from 10 to 50 million ARR and 50 to 200 million ARR, let's say. And I think at these different stages of the growth life cycle in a company, you also have to understand what is the skill set that you require from your executive leadership, and can they actually deliver on that, or can they as the company grows, can they actually step up their their ownership, their responsibility set, and because the problems change from within these different stages. So I think in hindsight, I have seen our executive team develop and change in the meantime, right? Like in some cases, we had to be very upfront with some of our leaders and sit down and have a totally transparent conversation about like, hey, we feel like we've reached the ceiling and we're probably going to have to up level the way that we're doing things. And in certain cases, you know, the person decided that they like working mostly in the early stages of a startup and a company. In certain cases, the people were motivated to learn more from the new leaders that were coming in, and they wanted to stay, and we worked it out, and we found a relevant position within the company where they could stay close to the new leader and see how we built things from this point onwards. So I think there's many different cases. You really just have to be transparent with one another and set the right goals and objectives and see if we can make the leap. And if not, then that's totally fine. But then we have to up level the teams and the skill sets within the teams. And at times you just have to hire a new leader within the team, and that's that.
And what about, for example, when you're thinking about building a company, let's say at a seed stage versus, let's say, Series C, you know, type of a company, how do you need to be thinking differently?
I think in seed stage, it was really about just getting product market fit and hustling sort of like your way through early revenue growth. And that is what describes my days if I'm a seed stage founder. So I would drive demo calls all day long. And in between, I would be writing our blog posts for our search engine optimization strategy and hoping to drive some more inbound traffic onto our website that would convert into more demo calls that I could drive the next day. So then from seed to Series A, it was very much about that. And then Series A onwards, it was about, okay, let's, like, what we've done so far seems to be working. We found the relevant verticals that we can address and solve their use cases. So let's add more heads into the organization. And that's exactly what we did. And as we neared Series B, that's when we should have processized and implemented systems, processes, and up-leveled our leadership. And I think we were too late to do that. So that took us a year to year and a half to identify. And then that resulted in us having to cut back in certain areas and actually tear down certain teams that we had built up. And then we had to go from there onwards. And last year has been about operational excellence for us. And our CRO joined beginning of last year. And I think he's brought great value to our executive team and he's definitely setting the bar high for a lot of us. And so we doubled down on operational excellence and ensuring that we dedicate enough resources and time on actually making our company scalable from this point onwards and making our teams investable. And that's what we had focused on for the past year. And I'd say we're in a very good shape now and we're in a place where we've been able to gain good US traction. We've closed some deals that I'm rather proud of. And I think we're going to end this year on very good terms, and I'm happy where we are right now.
Amazing. So then let's talk about vision here. Imagine you were to go to sleep tonight, Benson. You wake up in a world where the vision, you know, for the company is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Look, we're in an industry which is very impactful. We operate in an industry that is very impactful. We are helping stop bad actors from doing what they are. And that has like implications on consumers being safer. It has implications on businesses saving money, less cost of fraud, and you can invest in that money that you would have lost in other areas. And generally, I truly believe that we're driving towards the greater good here. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't mean that we're going to be able to stop all the fraudsters everywhere around the world, right? Like, this is sort of a cat and mouse game, and you decide whether we're the cat or we're the mouse, because fraudsters, the reason why they're so good at doing what they do is they're generally very good at identifying loopholes, finding the gaps, and then it's all about like plugging those in, and maybe you can stay a step ahead for a certain period of time, but after a while, these actors are just very good at finding loopholes generally. So all in all, I think we're addressing a very important issue, and I'm ready to double down in helping more businesses there than ever before. And I think in the US, I've seen some very good signs of moving towards helping enterprise customers as well in order to solve their fraud issues, which I'm very proud of the revenue team for actually getting us to a place where we're enterprise ready. And on the other hand, since this is a growing issue, I don't see it going anywhere. And like I said earlier, my aspiration is to definitely go public one day. And I do believe that the company that we're building, we're very healthy from a financial perspective. Like I said, you had asked around our business model. I think this is a business model that is very clear cut. It's plain and simple. The more you use our tool, the more you pay, basically. And so that's where we're at. I'm just excited to be in the space. And I think we started with my co-founder at the right time. And I'm lucky to have him as a co-founder. And we'll see where this road takes us.
Well, you guys have been at it now for, you know, it's on its way to a decade, which is really remarkable. You know, in the world of startups, that's like 100 years in corporate, no? So if I was to put you, you know, into a time machine, Vince, and I bring you back in time, let's say to 2015, where you guys were thinking about a world where you could, you know, take ownership of your own, you know, destiny. And let's say you were able to go back and have a chat with your younger self and give that younger Benz one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Ooh, there's so many things that I had learned and learned year over year. I think definitely I underestimated in the early days the time spent on strategic alignment. You know, we had thought that just basic. I think we let a lot of things fall in its place. And had we discussed it more, the outcome would have probably been better sooner. And I underestimated the amount of time that we spent on aligning on what the strategy should be for the given quarter. And then translating that strategy into a roadmap, and then actually enforcing accountability from different functions and leaders of those functions of the big rocks on the roadmap is very important today. And I'd say we had figured that out. It was always evolving, but we had figured that out now. So I think I underestimated that in the early days. It also took us a couple of times of failure or like having been faced with issues and hardships to learn to react to having to, you know, when you hit that ceiling that I talked about earlier with your leaders, I think that there was some times there where we were too late to identify that, and we had too much, I think we were emotionally attached to older ways of working, and we should have acted more quickly. And I think lastly, to sum up, like to any founder, a very useful piece of advice is if your gut tells you that something is wrong or you feel like you should change something, you probably should. So like don't wait to pull the trigger with that given thing. That's something that I've learned over the years is act quickly, because the more you wait, the bigger the problem goes or the worse the situation becomes and the bigger sort of ripple effects it's going to have. And that took some time to learn and master.
So, Ben, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
You can always reach me on LinkedIn. You can send me an email on benz@cion.io, and happy to, you know, to basically interact with anybody. And I talk to a bunch of founders, even at earlier stages. Sometimes we have dinner, sometimes we check in on Zoom calls. And I love giving back any of the knowledge that I had acquired over the years. I love giving back to the community. And I know I have conversations with founders that are in later stages as well, where I try to understand how they would think about a certain problem. And it turns out the problems are very much similar in every different case, no matter the company. I definitely, anybody can reach me if they want to.
Amazing. Well, Benj, well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Alejandro, for having me. And thanks to the listeners for chiming in.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.